Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:53 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off with this chart. So it is the implied yield on the 3 month in 18 months' time, taking away the 3 month yield as it is today. And we're up to 250. Well, in fact, it's 295 basis points. But the reality here is that this is an artificially constructed rate. Now, it's not because the individual constituents are artificial rates, but we're seeing exogenous factors that are contributing to a significant compression in the three-month yield. And basing a forecast on inflation, or market it's almost as if the Federal Reserve is using it as a permission slip from the market to go off and raise rates. And that would appear to be a rather spurious argument. But nonetheless, we're in an environment where this is a really extraordinary set of circumstances, where we have a massive quantity of outstanding debt, which nobody is talking about. We've seen $18 trillion of bonds that have gone from a negative rate down to about $3 trillion with a negative yield. And there has been this wave of selling at the long end of the curve. And I think this is a really significant event that is not really being paid attention to by the Federal Reserve. So there are a couple of different ways we can look at this. It would be one thing if every spread that's notable in the markets was moving in the same direction and some were closer to inversion than others, but we're seeing one spread which is right at the shortest possible duration moving in one direction, which is higher, and everything else going lower. So the 10-year minus 2-year swap spread is down to almost inversion. And then we can think about the high yield spread. And this is just taking 10-year and 2-year maturities for high yield bonds away from one another. And we're back at tight levels that haven't been seen since the depths of the pandemic, but that was an extraordinary circumstance. Whereas what we can see now is that the current rate today is below where it was in 2019, and that was also a time when we'd had a significant inversion of the 10-year minus 3-month and also the tens and twos. So it's only during extremities of difficulty for the global economy that we tend to see the high yield spread lower than it is now. So this is another measure to say that liquidity conditions are already tightening up and that we're still in an environment where growth seems to be fine and corporate earnings have not yet taken a hit, but the credit markets are tightening up. So if we have high yield and swap spreads either in inversion or at extraordinary tight levels, that has to give anybody pause. Then we can just simply look at the acceleration that we're seeing in government bonds. And this huge move in yields that we've seen this week is really jaw-dropping. In the space of 3 weeks, the yield has rallied from 1.65% to 2.5%. And that's with a quarter point interest rate hike. So in an inflationary environment, long-dated bonds are allergic to that environment. It's almost like kryptonite. So investors then don't have a choice. They have to sell. And some people will go to cash. So And we can, I think it's also worth highlighting that before we go into what the ramifications are, this is we need to also look at the breadth of this move. So the 30-year has now broken out, and completing this range, pushing back above the 2.5% level. And the when we then think internationally, UK gilts are also breaking higher, and it has cleared the 1.5% level. We haven't seen levels around here since 2018, but it looks like we have momentum here. And now we're starting to see the 2-year trending up above the 1,000-day moving average. We haven't seen that since at least 2008. But the quantity of debt outstanding on international markets is substantially higher today than it was back then. So, when we think about the German Bund, until quite recently, it was at negative territory, and in the space of 3 weeks, it has come from negative to 60 basis points. So we're back now at levels not seen since 2018. And again, the momentum is on the upside because the 200-day moving average is now trading back above the 1,000-day moving average. And that is generally a pretty sound indication that we are in a new trend. Now, of course, we had a similar type of situation back in 2007 and 8, and we did have inflationary fears back in 2007 and 2008 because the global economy had been doing so well for so long and in commodity price inflation was taking off. So we also then had the introduction of the iPhone in 2008, and then we had the 4G revolution that continued to create a technology-led disinflationary cycle. We still had globalization, and the intensification of globalization certainly helped as a disinflationary force. So today we have much higher debt. We have less geopolitical cohesion and much more evidence of geopolitics playing a deleterious role on valuations and security and the resilience of the global supply chain. Then, of course, we have the pandemic that is still rumbling along in the background and affecting different countries with different intensities. And then there's the additional question of what's going to be the next big thing in the technology sector to create a disinflationary force. Well, these are all very big questions, but let's first think about where is the money coming from? Because back in 2008, we had the beginning of the quantitative easing cycles. And arguably today, we're coming to the end of some of these quantitative easing cycles. So we certainly need to think about money. Well, if investors are selling out of longer-dated bonds, then they have a couple of different things they can do. They can go straight to cash, and the dollar remains quite steady. And as long as the Federal Reserve is talking about raising rates and talking about reducing the size of the balance sheet, well, then that's going to restrict the supply of the dollar and increase its price. And that's generally bullish overall. So we should anticipate that the dollar will remain steady for as long as that remains the case. And then we can think about what's happening in stock markets. Well, investors have been willing to support stock markets. They are looking at the attractive qualities of stocks, particularly those that have long records of paying dividends, because dividend growth is a hedge against inflationary pressures, share buybacks, reducing the quantity of outstanding shares, is a hedge against the loss of purchasing power coming through from inflation. And of course, there is the potential that companies can raise prices. So then you have the dividend achievers, you have the or the dividend aristocrats, the buyback achievers, and then you have the quality type companies that should do well in this type of environment, because if you have a quality business, you generally do get pricing power. And these types of resilient companies, well, they generally tend to be all-weather type investments. So they should start to attract interest as people start to move away from bonds. Then we're definitely also seeing some questioning. What happens to the most interest rate sensitive portion of the market if interest rates rise? How are these speculative companies, which don't have profits, how are they going to prosper in this kind of environment? Now, obviously, we've already seen a significant sell-off. So there's obviously a big question to answer here. Are we going to see a reversion to the mean? Will there be additional short covering as investors start to think that perhaps a decline from 160 to 60 is sufficiently bearish enough to have priced in worst-case scenarios for some of these companies? But the whole reason that the sector was able to do so well in 2020 was because of this massive supply of new money. And without that massive supply of new money, well, what's going to fund these types of companies? Are they then going to have to accelerate their path towards profitability and give up on attaining global market share? Well, that might create better companies, but then it would be difficult to justify their valuations even at today's levels. So it is extremely likely that as long as interest rates are rising, these types of companies are going to experience little more than short covering and then potentially move into lengthy type 3 bottoming characteristics, which would be ranging phases at depressed levels, but volatile trading within those ranges for what could be years. And it will all depend on exactly what happens with interest rates overall. So we're definitely seeing some reordering of the global environment for stock markets. And the ability of companies to increase their dividends, buy back their shares, raise prices, is obviously very finely attuned to the health of the economy. So we're definitely now seeing some correlation. As bond yields rise, stocks are appreciating, because people are hedging that exposure to inflation with stock portfolios. So we've had a meaningful rebound for the Nasdaq, for the S&P 500, for the Dow Jones. In some cases, we had upside weekly key reversals, and this week we had upside follow-through. So we're coming back into the region of the 200-day moving average, and we might even see prices push up towards the highs. But the big question then is, if bond yields do continue to rise and it takes a toll on the ability of companies to generate profits or raise prices, well, then it would be unusual for stocks to persist in that strong performance. So then we have to then raise the question, if the Federal Reserve in particular is talking about quantitative tightening and raising rates, then where is the new money going to come from to fuel bull markets? And are we in for a lengthier period of volatile, ranging, and difficult trading environments until we see that new money? Well, the Federal Reserve hasn't begun to taper just yet, and that's helping to support stock markets. Now, they have about $9 trillion on their balance sheet, and over $5 trillion of that is U.S. Treasuries, and about $1 trillion of those have maturities this year. So if the Fed were to re-engage with quantitative tightening and take money out of circulation, they're already saying that they would like to do it faster than last time. Well, last time it took them about a year and a half to take $750 billion out of circulation. They could double the pace this time, take 9 months to take $750 billion out of circulation, or they could take $1 trillion out of circulation within a year. So that would be a doubling in the pace of their quantitative tightening program, and it would take the size of the balance sheet down to about $8 trillion. Now, we know what's happened on every other occasion that central banks have attempted to engage in quantitative tightening. They've had to double the size of the balance sheet following quantitative tightening. We've seen that with the Federal Reserve, and we saw it with the ECB back in 2014. They took $1 trillion out of circulation, and when they got deflation and got scared by that, well, then they had to double the size of the balance sheet to just get things back to an even keel. So we know what the end solution is going to be, and the bigger question then is, how much of a decline is going to be necessary to change the minds of Federal Reserve and central bank officials around the world? Because it's not a pullback of 10%. It's usually a pullback of about 20%, and a growth scare will be required to change their minds. So then it really only is a question of what has to happen in order for the stock market to begin to pull back. Well, growth is obviously going to be a factor there. Now, when we think about what are the other potential hedges against inflation, well, gold is certainly one of those. And it continues to firm from the $1,900 area. And Bitcoin is also starting to attract interest, because if growth starts to moderate, well, that's not going to be benign for stocks, and investors will then go in search of an alternative hedge. And considering that the 3-month yield is still only around 50 basis points, that's not going to be somewhere where it will attract anyone who doesn't need to own it. So then funds will start looking for alternative assets. Well, some will move into the private sector and private equity, and the private portion of the market is becoming progressively more powerful. And this opaque nature of the private equity sector and where the money goes, how they're accruing it, what kind of investments they're making, these are going to be really substantial questions the next time we do have a recession. I've been party to a number of conversations over the years, and the one thing that has really cropped out to me is just how many of the big pension funds, like the education pension funds, and not just in the USA but globally, have been investing in private equity. And they buy, or at least in the conversations that I've been party to, they've been buying in the third and fourth rounds, where assets have already significantly appreciated, but they've been willing buyers coming in. And that's obviously a challenge. Now, as we look at Bitcoin, it's got an evolving wedgie type characteristic. and it's coming up towards that 45,000 level, and it has failed at 45,000 on at least three occasions over the course of the last 3 months. So now the question is, what happens next? With this wedging characteristic, the chances are that when the breakout comes, it's going to be emphatic. And we saw an emphatic breakout with gold, and that was also a wedgy characteristic. So I think it's reasonable to anticipate that when Bitcoin does eventually break out, that it's going to do so in an emphatic and surprising manner. But gold prices are also likely to do well in this environment. And so far, this looks like a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak. And when we could just pull in the back history, this could be just a first step above the base. And if that's the case, well, then we should anticipate that gold will break out to new all-time highs, not just simply on a nominal basis, but that it will also break out in a purchasing power parity basis. And that's going to be one of the, I think, defining characteristics of this bull market, that gold will start to offer a clear hedge against inflation. Then, if we're going to answer where's the money going to come from to fire up the next portion of a secular bull market, well, then it's got to come from somewhere. So, if growth moderates, then that will start to kill off inflation, and bond yields would start to come back down, and the Federal Reserve will be forced to cut interest rates and start to print money once more. And then more liquidity will become forthcoming. So there is certainly the potential here that gold will do well in that kind of environment because the purchasing power of currencies will be sacrificed to support an economy that's slowing down, and that should be benign for gold prices. Of course, then there's the big question about what's going to happen with China. So we've had this substantial rebound in the Hang Seng over the last 3 weeks, where it went from 18 to 22,000 points in the space of a week. And now we're starting to see the price pausing here. And it hasn't quite yet broken the downtrend, despite the fact that we've had a good-sized rebound. So it needs to hold the low, and then it needs to push on to new recovery highs. It looks like we are in for at least another retest of the low. And there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen next with the pandemic in China. I think that China has pretty much backed itself into a corner because the extremely strict lockdowns they engaged in during 2020, they might have been exceptionally uncomfortable for citizens, but they did work in containing the spread of the virus. Well, the Omicron and Deltacron variants are much more transmissible, so then that's also going to create an additional challenge for governments that are attempting to engage in these exceptionally strict lockdowns. Well, the number of cases around China is ramping higher, and factories have had to close down, and that's tended to weigh on some of the technology shares, and it's enhancing the potential that we're going to have another supply disruption in terms of the global supply chain. So the Baltic Dry Index has rebounded really emphatically over the last 6 weeks, and it's pausing now in the region of the 200-day moving average. What's China going to do if the coronavirus becomes as much of a problem there as it has been in Hong Kong? Because they are closing down vast swathes of the economy, almost 60 or something like 70% of the country has had some kind of lockdown introduced over the course of just the last couple of weeks. And no country has really successfully been able to beat back the Delta and Omicron variants. So now the question is, will they start to print money? We've seen the rebound on the Hang Seng on the promise of them printing money, and the renminbi has just begun to weaken. So there's the potential here that China will be forced to engage in the same kind of liquidity provision that other countries had to during 2020. And there's the scope, at least, that that will contribute to a weaker currency, and that if we do see a weaker currency and that it continues to extend the downtrend with the dollar pushing up on this chart, that should be benign for the domestic stock market. It should also be benign for anyone who relies on China to buy their imports. But then, of course, we have the additional question of the oil price. So crude oil is starting to steady once more and still hovering here around the $120 area. And rockets successfully landed on Saudi Aramco properties in here today. So that helped to support the oil price. We're in an environment right now where supplies of liquids are really tight. So that is something that's going to add to volatility in the commodity markets overall. So I think when we think about what we can anticipate here, it's a rather difficult environment, because all other factors being equal, you would think that with oil prices rising, there'd be a supply response. But we're in an environment where there's a lot of concern about low liquidity. So if that's the case, well, we're then likely to have more volatility. And if we have more volatility, it means that prices are susceptible to shocks on the upside. And eventually there will be supply responses, but it's going to take time to rebuild supply. It's going to take time to refill storage. And right now, we have a short-term overbought condition. So it's likely that we get some consolidation. But, and I would think that we should get consolidation. We should probably see lower to lateral ranging. But if supply in Saudi Arabia is also under threat, as well as the difficulties with anyone purchasing Russian oil, then those are obviously going to be significant factors that help to support prices. Surging oil prices contribute to inflations and also contribute to recessions. So we can look at the tight financial conditions that are out there in the bond markets, and we can think about the exodus from the long end of the bond curve. So that's a really significant factor. It's going to contribute to higher borrowing costs for governments. And again, there's nobody talking about this. So the interest expense of refinancing at a significantly higher interest rate is, I think, rather significant. We can simply look at it on a mortgage basis. If you're borrowing $100,000 at 3.5%, you pay $449 in interest, or in as a payment. If it goes up to 4.5%, well, then you spend an extra $57. But $57 on 449, well, then we're talking about a 1 in 9. So it's an almost 10% increase in the payment. Well, then obviously that's exactly the same kind of calculation that's going to go into what's happening with government finances. And we saw a taste of what that looks like in the UK this week. So the UK budget announced that, basically that they're going to cut some taxes, but they didn't change the bands. And because they didn't change the bands and inflationary pressures are rising, and then that wages are rising, it means that more people will be in the higher band, and it will result in more income getting taken for the government. And that's just going to contribute to lower living standards. People might be making more, but they might be making more on the headline and paying more on taxes, and then their purchasing power will be eroded by inflationary pressures. So these are significant factors for the vast majority of people. And the UK has got one of the longest dated durations on its sovereign debt than any other country, because the duration on the debt for the UK is in excess of a decade. Well, for the USA, it's less than 5 years. So the 5-year yield has been ramping higher. And this represents an additional interest service expense for the US government. We're almost back up to the levels that the rate peaked at back in early 2019. So these are really significant events, and we really haven't seen a marked response in stocks just yet. But it's absolutely inevitable, because there's going to be a slowdown in growth. And then the question is the Federal Reserve going to flinch? Are they going to do exactly the same on this occasion as they have done on every other occasion? Or are they suddenly, do they suddenly have a newfound tolerance for recessions? And will they accept lower GDP in order to control inflationary pressures? And I just don't believe they have the stomach for that. I've been quite vocal in thinking that I thought they would do one and done in terms of interest rates. The market continues to price in the potential that they could do as many as 6 additional ones, and then I saw one person today speculating that they will have at least 4 50 basis point hikes between now and the end of the year, which would imply an additional 2% on the yield. But the 5-year yield is up from 1.25 to 2.5. So it has doubled this year, and we're still only in March. And it bottomed at 25 basis points 2 years ago. So the cost of servicing the USA's debt has risen 200 basis points in the space of less than 2 years. And the quantity of debt outstanding is still rising, and they're running deficits, and the duration of their debt is low. And the Federal Reserve is now stopping buying bonds, and they want to start running off their balance sheet. So we're going to start to see tightening. And the moratorium on collecting, or the moratorium on forgiving the payments on education debt, is about to run off. The savings as a percentage of consumption have completely mean reverted and are in fact below where they were before the pandemic. So we're starting to see that when we think about some of these retail type companies, Etsy experienced a really impressive advance in 2021, and now it's struggling in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Well, Etsy is one of those marketplaces where people anticipate they're going to get somewhat better service and they go there for something they can't really find somewhere else, like handmade goods. Amazon is where people shop for convenience and don't pay that much attention to pricing. And the share is in the region of the 200-day moving average. It's bounced from the 1,000-day moving average and now testing the lower side of the overhead trading range. So it's at the do or die moment. If we think about Walmart, well, Walmart is where people who are very price conscious shop. And the share has been ranging for a year already and is now pausing and has not quite yet broken the sequence of lower rally highs that's been evident since, what was it, August of last year. When we think about the discounters, those where people really only shop there because they can't afford to shop elsewhere, well, they're trending downwards. TJX might be a better class of discounter than Ross Stores, and it's also now back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The fact that this is occurring before a recession, rather than during a recession, should be giving policymakers pause. Instead, I think it's academically dishonest to simply look at 3-month forward rates and think that that's an indication of what the market thinks, if we're already seeing evidence of slowdown. So there's obviously money that is available, and we're still seeing demand for commodities, and copper prices remain steady. But if the global economy slows down, well, then it's arguable that enough of money will be spent on renewable energy to sustain the strength that we have seen since the lows back in 2020. And it really is a question about oil prices being supported by supply shocks. But we don't have a supply shock for copper. What we've had is a demand shock. And the demand shock is about the success of the global economy. We've definitely started to see companies like Tesla raising prices. Their so-called budget car, the Model 3, which started out supposed to be somewhere around $35,000, now costs $47,000. So that's helping to support the share, and it got back up to test the $1,000 area in here this week. And Nvidia is still saying that people are willing to trade up and pay more for their graphics cards, so they do have pricing power, and that's helped them to continue to hold the region of the 200-day moving average. And then Apple came out today and said that they're going to basically start financing a subscription model for their handsets. So they're aware of the fact that people don't have $1,000 to go out and buy a new phone, and particularly so when the government isn't giving people money for nothing. So the company is going to adopt a subscription business model. Now, that's been transformative for lots of other companies, where they make it easier for people to own their products or to lease their services, and therefore they broaden their base of subscribers. Now, what Apple might like to do is to sell a subscription so that they will encourage more of their existing customers to trade up into newer handset models or to go for premium items. And that would be a money spinner. And the share has certainly responded favorably over the last 2 weeks, and it continues to hold the region of the 200-day moving average. So what we can definitely see here is that some of the larger companies have a sufficiently large moat that they are prospering in an inflationary environment, and that's a positive. But then we also have companies where they're losing their moat, and Adobe is one of those. And this was a company that basically invented the subscription business model. They were certainly one of the first companies to adopt it. And the share did exceedingly well following the introduction of the subscription business model. Going from 50 to 700 in the space of a decade is an impressive advance. And it has since pulled back violently. And the reason for that is not because of the business model, but because their moat is not sufficiently defensible. There are video and photo editing pieces of software that compete with Adobe everywhere, and particularly on social media. People just don't need to invest in Adobe any longer. They have lots of additional products that are cheaper. So there's no real need to continue to hold. And this is problematic. When a company that had a defensible moat a decade ago loses it because their business model was so successful, well, that is a cautionary tale for everyone else. It's therefore important to monitor the consistency of their trends. Adobe failed to sustain the upward break and then failed to find support in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now it's back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average for the first time in a decade. This has been a massive loss of uptrend consistency, and it's probably going to be a sell on the rallies kind of share for the foreseeable future. Then we can think about the biotechnology sector. And there's been a significant reweighting going on over the course of the last year. It came back from 180 to 120, and that was basically excising the weightings of the vaccine producers. So Moderna surged because it had one of the best vaccines that got the best sales during the pandemic. Then it gave it all up because Pfizer claimed the crown. So it was really was a winner takes all type of market. Now, Moderna has lots of plans for really exciting future potential and not a great deal of evidence that they're going to be able to skip the queue in terms of development timelines. So it's going to be years before they get any chance of selling an mRNA-based AIDS vaccine, for example. But the biotechnology sector's other high-growth markets have been largely ignored during the pandemic, and now they represent larger weightings within the biotech ETF, and they should prosper provided they provide realizable solutions to intractable problems. So we're definitely in a transition phase. There are portions of the global market will continue to do well. There are others are uniquely sensitive to interest rates and are going to experience difficulty. We have to anticipate that growth is going to moderate. We're already starting to see that consumers are being pressured both by the rise in rents and the rise in gasoline prices, and that's going to impact at their ability to make purchases. and sales are starting to ebb in the retail sector, and savings have already been eroded. So the sensitivity of the US economy to interest rates is much higher than the Federal Reserve thinks, or that the market is willing to consider at the present time. But we're unlikely to see a change in the trend of action by the Federal Reserve until the S&P 500 is back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The higher the stock market continues to go, the greater the likelihood is that the Federal Reserve will continue to raise rates. They'll view the continued resilience of the stock market as a green light for their policy of raising rates, and they'll conclude that investors would rather them tackle inflation now than have to deal with a bigger inflationary problem in future. If that's indeed the case, well, then we might see significant additional interest rate hikes. But I still really do believe that we're going to see a significant headwind in terms of falling growth before they ever get around to big interest rate hikes. And I think that what we're looking at now in slow motion is exactly what happened to Europe back in, well, I guess it was a decade ago. The ECB tried to raise rates, and subsequently they had to cut them to zero. So back in 2011, they raised rates twice, and the economy couldn't accept it. And after that, they had to cut rates to the bone and have never been able to raise them. And Japan has had similar conditions. So they haven't been able to raise rates for decades. And they're still in an environment where they are trying to court inflation. And the yen continues to trend lower because Japan hasn't got a notion of abandoning its quantitative easing program. So we certainly know there's going to be an abundance of yen. And this is also contributing to the yen carry trade, because if the yen is going down and there's an abundance of it and there are no interest rates, well, there's an easy carry that one can invest in yields elsewhere and pick up that carry, or invest in higher yielding stocks and pick up the carry. So this at least is one source of potential liquidity. Then there's also the potential that Australia is going to do better. The ASX 200 is back above the 200-day moving average. The Australian dollar is beginning to steady. There's certainly going to be demand for the kinds of things that Australia exports, like coal and gas and iron ore. And we're starting to see that some of the steel producers around the world are doing better and approaching the upper side of base formations for ArcelorMittal, pushing up out of first steps above the base for companies like Cleveland-Cliffs. So these are really significant moves. It suggests that there will be infrastructure development. There will be money made available to try and achieve those climate goals. And there will certainly be money made available to enhance resilience in the energy sector. Continuing to rely on Russia as a major supplier of energy isn't really conducive to try and combating their expansionary tactics in Eastern Europe. So, regardless of what happens, in terms of inflation. There's got to be money made available to build that kind of infrastructure. So European natural gas prices were a little lower in here today because the USA and Europe announced a deal that they're going to try and supply Europe with about 50, I can't remember if it's billion or million cubic feet. I think it's billion cubic feet of gas before the end of the year. Well, Europe imports about 150 of those from Russia. So that's really just going to start to chip away at that reliance on Russian energy. Well, regardless of what happens, that infrastructure is going to get built. And China is going to have to stimulate if they want to avoid a really significant hit to their economy. So we could see some additional liquidity coming into the market. And that's why I think that if growth does slow, then we are going to see at least a pause in inflationary pressures. That will give cover to central banks to begin to reintroduce liquidity. And we move back into an expansionary cycle for the global economy. And we can think about the renewable energy sector, where we've had a bounce on the wind sector, and then it's encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And it will have to push up and through that 200-day moving average to confirm a low of medium-term significance. And it's exactly the same for the solar sector. I don't think that stock markets are going to continue to trend higher in an uninterrupted fashion. I think we are due at least a retest of the lows, and then potentially somewhat more than that. And then we'll see what happens with central banks. But the one thing we know for certain is that if the supply of liquidity is being threatened, that's going to contribute to much more choppy action on stock markets. When they eventually demur and create additional liquidity, well, then the focus of attention will be on infrastructure development. And that's why we're seeing relative strength coming through in that portion of the market. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.